don't create sort of all this anxiety for yourself because you're not pursuing it in the way that you think you should be pursuing something. I think I always thought I might get to where I want to get in a roundabout way, but that's okay. So I would just trust who you are and trust the path you want to take and not be so hard on yourself if you're not doing exactly how you think you should.
How's it going?
It's going okay. You know, as much as anyone in this country can feel okay, I'm okay, I guess.
I know, it's been crazy. Todd, this is my friend Anna. She is a freelance broadcaster.
Hi, how are you?
I'm actually shooting a wedding in August.
Yes, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've already had to reschedule twice, so.
Reschedule all there. Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
My friend just told us he's doing May 7th, and I'm like, I don't know. I feel like you should.
Where's that wedding?
Oh, it's actually 2021. I'm really.
Oh.
It's in the Caribbean, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Like a destination wedding, so.
Oh, man. Are you in L.A. right now?
Yeah.
Man, how's it going over there?
It's okay. I mean, it's been interesting because people here, I mean, as you probably read, like, the governor and the mayor with the COVID stuff has been, you know, things have been pretty strict. So it's just been a weird thing where everyone's been stuck at home. And then all of a sudden these protests happen. Now everyone's out in the street and those have been kind of crazy. And it's been a weird couple months.
Yeah.
Yes.
Man.
Everyone's it's
been nuts here too in Charleston. We're here. It's been so crazy. But are you, do you need to be somewhere between now? I try to keep the podcast interview within 90 minutes or so, an hour. But let us know if you need to be somewhere we can, you know, plan.
Yeah, no, I have nowhere to be, so.
I just got to plug my computer real quick because I think I'm running on battery, but I'll be right back. Hang on just a second.
Can you guys go anywhere in LA right now, or are you just strictly housebound?
Well, people are going places now. I think as of probably 3 weeks ago, they opened things back up officially. Parks and, you know, obviously with restrictions, and some of the beaches are open. But before that, we couldn't really go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Now people are kind of out, but we're trying to be cautious and strict about it because it feels weird that we were housebound for 3 months and not a ton has changed. And now all of a sudden everyone's out and doing what they used to do. It seems
I know.
We're going to be back housebound again. So
Are you able to do any work at home, Todd, or pretty much?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a gift and a curse, but I was starting to edit a project like right before this all happened. It was a weird circumstance. The editor, it's in Spanish. It's an immigration documentary. Mm-hmm. And so I had a Spanish editor, obviously, and a couple days into our edit, he, for unforeseen circumstances, had to drop out of it. So I was in the process of finding another editor, and then all the COVID stuff happened. So I basically just decided I was going to edit it myself, and I don't know Spanish, so that's been a little tricky. But I've spent basically the last 2 months kind of editing this doc. So it's kept me busy and, you know, paid, which I'm thankful for and all that stuff. So, basically just been doing that for 2 months, sitting in my office editing at home. So,
wow. Well, I want to ask you about that. I told a little bit, to Anna about it. I know you told me last year, I think you were getting ready to shoot this project. I want to ask you maybe a little later, but, I want to thank you for hopping on and giving us your time. I know you're very busy and, but I appreciate you and very grateful for your time for hopping on, Todd.
Of course, thanks.
Yeah. I want to start by just really kind of letting you know also, like, over email, I told you kind of what the purpose was for our podcast. I want to create the content and give value to a lot of film creators out there, new creators that are trying to break it into the market and really trying to figure out where they fit in or how they can be on, you know, how they can move to the next level like you. So I wanted to kind of ask you some questions, and then I want to jump in probably and ask you about the film. But I love Dennis Rodman. I told you, I think I sent you an email and several messages how I love that project. And I think it was such eye candy for me whenever I watched it. Composition, the colorization, everything you did about the interview. I mean, it was awesome, man. And I want to kind of go through that and kind of ask you a couple questions about the project. And so I want to go jump and get started. But before we do that, I want to kind of give our listeners an opportunity to know about you. Tell me who you are and what you do. Take it away.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I guess now I'm a director because I did a 30 for 30, and that's what they call the person who's in charge of that. You know, before that, I would have considered myself a feature producer, I guess, because I've worked in television now for, it's over 10 years in different capacities. You know, started off as like a production assistant working on studio shows, and then I was an associate producer on some shows at ESPN, and then I went to Fox and was a feature producer, and then did some kind of things, I guess, that would be considered films because they were in film festivals, and then eventually, you know, now I completed a 30 for 30. So yeah, I guess I'm a filmmaker, which is, you know,
that's awesome.
A cool title.
Did you go to school for this, Todd? And where did you go to school?
No, actually, I went to Brown University in Rhode Island. I actually was, you know, it's funny, my education is interesting because I was a political science and history double major. But even back then, even in high school, I think I had sort of this pipe dream of always, you know, making a film, or, you know, I more wanted to get into the scripted kind of narrative stuff when I was younger. But, you know, when I went to college, I just wanted to get a good overall education. And maybe even I was a little scared to sort of make that leap and say, oh, I want to make films and I'm going to study that in college. But I still always had that in the back of my mind. And I took courses at Brown, some film courses, and they actually have a great design school in Providence, the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD, which I tried to take some courses there, which were sort of art filmmaking classes. So, you know, while I was getting my degree in, I guess, the liberal arts, I sort of always had this dream in the back of my head and this interest. So, but yeah, I didn't major in film or ever study film. And right after Brown, I got an internship at ESPN. And that sort of took my career in that direction in sports television.
Where was that ESPN internship? Was that in LA?
No, it was in Bristol at their headquarters, Bristol, Connecticut. So I lived in Bristol for, I guess, almost 7 years, 6.5 years. So 2006, I graduated, got an very, very low paying internship at ESPN. And everyone kind of starts in that program if you want to kind of, you know, go through the ranks to become a producer there. So 2006, I was a production assistant trainee. You work on SportsCenter, you cut highlights, you do montages, you know, cut sound, kind of just all the basic TV stuff. So that was in Bristol, Connecticut, where their headquarters is. So not the most glamorous place to spend your 20s, but I weathered it, and now I'm in LA, which is a slightly more fun place. So it was worth it.
I had a lot of friends from college who are still doing the PA out in Bristol, and they'd probably say the same exact thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was the thing about ESPN, it's such an interesting place. I mean, there's a reason that a lot of books have been written about the culture there, and living there and working there, there's a lot of great things about it. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of bad things with being so, you know, there's an insular culture there, and it's very insulated from the outside world, which can be good and bad. But, you know, I had 7 years there. It was cold. It was kind of boring, but a lot of the people I met there were awesome. And the on-the-job training was so cool. I mean, I went to multiple NBA finals. I went to NASCAR events. I went to the Ryder Cup in 2008. So a lot of cool experiences that I couldn't have gotten at any other network, I don't think. So again, it was a trade-off of my 20s in Bristol versus really cool work. Yeah. Experience,
man. 7 years is, I mean, that's a long time to be in a job in this lifetime. What can you give us a Cliff Notes version, like, how from, you know, being an intern to working on this 3430 project? Like what were your steps? How did you?
Yeah. So, well, it was tough too. And not to complain, because I know graduates go through varying levels of this every year, but you know, when I graduated, the financial crisis in 2008 happened. So that was a tough thing, because I basically started at the end of 2006. So 2007, as an intern. And then, you know, again, I think when you start there as a PA, you're just, and Anna probably knows this from her friends, but you do kind of the low end basic television work to make all these shows run, which is very, very important. But you're, again, you're going through all the sound and clipping off sound bites for the show. You're, what I did for a lot of it, and what a lot of trainees did back then, when like highlights were so important. Now they're not so important because you can pull up your phone and watch them. But when I started, wasn't necessarily the case. People still watch SportsCenter for highlights and to hear Stuart Scott and Scott Van Pel read highlights. So a lot of it was watching games all day, and you'd get assigned a game or two, and you'd watch the whole game, and you'd log it, and then you'd cut the highlight, then you'd write the highlight for the anchor, and then you sort of walk the anchor through, you know, the game that you were assigned that day. So my early couple of years was that, but then you're also assigned to different shows. I worked on like NBA Fast Break as a PA, again, kind of cutting highlights, cutting the B-roll, cutting the sound. And I was actually a PA, and that's why I brought up 2008. They had a hiring freeze, sort of a promotions freeze at ESPN from 2008 to like 2010. So I got caught in a pretty tough spot in terms of just career-wise, and thought about leaving a few times, because, you know, I was a PA for probably 3 years, which, you know, wouldn't have happened if that crisis hadn't happened. So I think by about 2010-11, I got promoted to associate producer, which is essentially you're doing similar things. Mm-hmm. Kind of working on shows, but you're more of a content creator when you're an associate producer. So I worked on NBA Countdown, I cut the tees for NBA Countdown, which was really cool for many years. And that was an awesome experience, because the crew then was Magic Johnson, Stuart Scott, Michael Wilbon, and John Barry, which, you know, I got to, you know, cut stuff for a show that Magic Johnson was on, and travel with those guys a little bit, which was really cool. So that, I think, just if we're talking about, I guess, my personal progression, is when I started cutting stuff for the NBA, I started to realize that I really liked editing. I really liked putting video together to music. Because when you're a PA, you're just cutting highlights and kind of doing the dirty work. But when I was an AP and working on the NBA, I got a lot of leeway to, I think I cut my first feature. I did a Rajon Rondo feature where he's up Boston. Well, not that he's on the Lakers now, but at the time he was with the Boston Celtics, went to Boston and shot something with him. As I might have actually been a PA at that point, and kind of just pushed to do it into this short little 4-minute feature that kind of put me on the map a little bit internally with those people, because I was a PA going out and shooting a feature. But I think those probably third, fourth year, I realized, okay, I don't really want to be in the studio sitting in the chair, you know, calling out cameras or kind of dictating necessarily the content for an overall show. I like doing the features or the teases or, you know, the promos. That's what I realized I was good at, and I enjoyed doing that. Then from there, I just started producing features. ESPN has a unit, or they did, I'm not sure if it still exists, but they call it the feature unit. There's probably like 50 people in that, and they basically do every short doc feature for the entire network. You have E60, which is a separate show, but then you have the feature unit, which does most of the features for ESPN. So I got into that unit, did that for probably 3 years, which was great too. I worked on College Game Day, which is a really awesome show, and did features for that. So traveled to a lot of college campuses doing interviews and features with talent that ESPN has, which was really fun. Did some NFL stuff. And then Fox Sports 1 started in Los Angeles, and they sort of recruited me to come out to LA for the launch of that. So that was, I guess, 2013. In my sort of sixth year at ESPN, I decided I had enough of Bristol. And I loved ESPN. I mean, that's why a lot of people stay there their whole career, because you know, the people are great, and you just get caught up in that system and you don't want to leave. But I just knew that I wasn't going to stay there my whole career. And I had kind of different aspirations maybe than just staying in TV and sports TV for my whole career. So left and went to FS1 when they were launching as a feature producer there too. And then I did that for, I'm trying to think how long I was at Fox Sports One, maybe 2 years till 2015, maybe. Sad to say that the network just wasn't doing well. The show I was technically doing features for, Fox Sports Live, they canceled the show. There was like new man, the president, was replaced at Fox Sports One, and he got rid of that show. So I was, my position was eliminated, which was kind of a gift and a curse, because another, the executive producer of that show was sort of on his way out too. And he was a big advocate of mine and a great mentor and a friend of mine now, Mike Hughes. And he had a production company before he took that position as executive producer of that show. And his plan all along was to kind of go back to his production company, reopen it. So when he did that, he kind of recruited me to start coming up with projects, and we worked together on some things. And he had a relationship with ESPN and the 30 for 30 Films people, because he was the executive producer of Pony Excess, which was one of the first 30 for 30s. I'm not sure which one it was, but it was in the first, it was in the original 30. It might've been like the 30th or 29th, 30 for 30. So he had a relationship with them. So we started brainstorming things that we could do together, athletes, topics. And then eventually we landed on Dennis Rodman as like a really interesting person who hadn't had a 30 for 30 yet.
What year was that when you started the conversation?
That was probably, it took a while actually to pitch ESPN or to land on the right approach. I think
17, 18?
Probably 18.
Yeah.
I think it was probably 2018 where we started to put a deck together and think about ways to tell the story. Because, you know, ESPN, it's funny, and I don't mean this in a negative way at all, but if you bring them a topic, they may say, well, yeah, this is great, but like, you know, what's the point of doing it now? There's got to be a hook, or what's the director's take? Which is, I only say it's funny because then you pitch them the right thing, and then once they say okay, then you kind of do whatever you want in a certain respect. So it's almost, I would make that argument with The Last Dance. It's like, you know, obviously everyone in the world watched all those 10 episodes and it was a massive hit and everyone loved it. But I don't think that they needed that video from that one season to do it. That was just ESPN's hook to do it. Right. I guess point being that they could have done that project 3 years ago, but ESPN did it because they wanted this hook of, oh, we have all this video from this one season. We're going to call it The Last Dance, but it was really 10 hours of just that whole 3 years with Michael and the Bulls. So
yeah.
Go ahead.
What inspired the project, Todd? How did this project come about as far as Dennis Rodman? I mean, you mentioned that he hasn't had one yet. He's a kind of like an interesting character. Was that the main thing, or who brought that up? How did that come about?
That was part of it. I think Mike asked me, you know, a lot of this stuff is relationships too. And Mike knew another partner, Doug Banker, on the project. He was friends or knew really well Dennis's agent. And I think they had been talking like, hey, you know, Dennis is at the point of his life. He's trying to clean himself up a little. He's obviously had problems with alcohol and his public image. He's trying to clean himself up. You know, we're trying to look for projects for him to do that would be interesting. And I think Dennis's agent kind of talked to Doug and said, you know, do you think there'd be any interest in a project? And Doug went to Mike and said, you know, any interest? And then Mike came to me and said, what do you think about a Dennis Rodman project? So it kind of just trickled down to me eventually. And, you know, I think Dennis is vastly interesting. And, you know, as soon as Mike brought him up, I said, yeah, of course, I'd love to try to develop something. I mean, I think part of the problem in documentary and in sports documentary in particular is like all these people, their stories have been told a lot. So part of my challenge was, well, how do we make this different? How do we just not do like a bio? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we kind of did do a bio, but at least we presented it in a way that hadn't been presented before. I think we dug in a lot deeper than anyone had before. So some of the information was already out there, but I think we packaged it in a way that was a lot different than people had seen. So that was, you know, Mike and I over about a course of a year kind of kept throwing decks at ESPN. How about this approach? How about this? We threw one which was all animation. We threw one that was, you know, just a straight bio with the four father figures, I think was one of the pitches we gave them, because he, you know, he had this family in Oklahoma that supported him, and then he had coaches throughout his life who supported him. So we just threw all these different ideas out, hoping one would stick, and eventually, you know, the one we pitched was fairly similar to what you saw on the screen, and ESPN liked that approach, and we moved forward.
Yeah, I think sometimes people think the easiest part is the title when naming these documentaries, but it likely was probably very difficult. So how did you land on Dennis Rodman, For Better or Worse?
It's actually a really, really good question. No one's asked me that, and you're exactly right. It was one of those things where it's almost like, you know, there's a million things that go into doing a documentary, and while you're doing it, always in the back of your head, like, I'm going to have to name this at some point.
And, right.
You know, ESPN's good, and they didn't really pressure us until the very end, but it's interesting. Throughout maybe the first 6 months of the project, in my head, I had always wanted something that was, I mean, if you watch the doc, it's pretty evident that Dennis is someone who craves, you know, he's the yearning for that sort of love and acceptance was destructive in a lot of ways. But, you know, in the back of my head, I always thought something like Rodman, please love me, or something with love that was like in your face and a little weird, was always what I was leaning towards. As we went along and I started suggesting these things, Mike, the EP, and ESPN sort of was like, that's like, let's just think more. No one really liked the ideas I was coming up with for names. So then I transitioned to just, let's keep it simple and just call it Rodman. And then ESPN said, well, we don't really do kind of one word, one name titles, which is fine. So we were kind of getting down to crunch time with naming it. It was probably a couple weeks before we even turned it in, which was very soon before it aired. So we didn't have a lot of time. So we were all kind of stressed about what to name it. And we had to cut to the chase of how we came up with it. Someone months before had suggested, you know, the most iconic image of Dennis, probably, especially if you're not a basketball fan or a sports fan, is Dennis in his wedding dress at the book signing. So a lot of the suggestions were, oh, could we do, you know, it's such a iconic moment. There's something we can do with the wedding dress, and ideas were thrown out that we all kind of thought were corny and cheesy. And I was like really against doing something with the wedding dress because it wasn't what Dennis's story is. Mm-hmm. It's not the story I was trying to tell. Certainly we have the outrageous stuff and who he became as kind of this crazy flamboyant icon, but that to me wasn't the heart of the story. So I shied away from that, but eventually, probably just from pressure of having to name it, it just kind of came to me one day, I think as I was sitting in edit, that, you know, we can connect the sort of wedding dress with, you know, Dennis's story, which obviously is up and down. Obviously some people love him, some people hate him. You kind of have to take him for better or worse. So it was just, you know, I don't have to explain the kind of dual meaning of it, but I think it was good enough. 2 weeks before the thing aired, we slapped that on, and you know, I think it was fine. But yeah, a lot of thought and time went into trying to figure that out. So yeah, it's a good question.
It's perfect. So I thought it was a good title. Todd, so you're the director, and what is exactly your role? Like, are you there for that every shoot? Are you telling people what to shoot, what to do? Did you grab the camera and, hey, let me do it myself? What exactly did you do? Can you walk us through that process?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want it to sound masturbatory, but you know, yeah, you do kind of do everything. I didn't shoot anything on this, I don't think, which I actually do a lot of when I do smaller projects, because I love shooting. I love, maybe more so than a lot of directors, I do love the technical aspect of camera technology and lensing and the color correction process and all that. But you know, for this project, I just wanted to leave it to the pros in terms of the shooting. So I didn't do any of the shooting, but yeah, it's kind of everything. I wrote the whole thing. You're coming up with the look of things. You're coming up with the graphical look. I mean, obviously there's a team, you know, Mike Hughes, who I've mentioned, he was the executive producer, helped a lot along the way. Matt Schleff, who was a producer, helped a ton of, you know, just setting things up and setting all these shoots up and telling me what lenses are available for the price that we, you know, in our price range for the budget and all that stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, it came down to me making a bunch of decisions about how stuff looked and the approach we wanted to take, who we wanted to interview, where we wanted to interview them. So kind of everything, yeah.
So with projects like these, Todd, is it, I know there's a lot of different variables with other shows, with other networks, Bravo TV and Netflix, but is this something that's self-funded, or are you on the ESPN payroll? Is this you mentioned earlier that you pitched it to ESPN along with Mike. How does that work with this particular project?
Yeah, and I think most, you know, ESPN, I think, buys some stuff. Like, they'll go to a film festival. I think that actually, don't quote me on this, but there's the Bruce Lee 30 for 30 that's coming out. I don't think that they internally came up with that and then hired a company to do it. I think they may have bought that. I don't hold me to that, but sometimes it works like that. Well, they'll buy stuff and put the 30 for 30 kind of label on it. But most of the things that they do are internally developed, and they will say they have budgets for those things. So when Doug and I went to ESPN and said we want to do this Dennis Rodman thing, and eventually they said yes, then they have a budget associated for an hour and a half or 2 hour 30 for 30. So that budget gets handed over to the production company, and then, you know, that's split up between paying certain people, because there's a lot of people who worked on it, and then the production budget, which obviously is used to make the film itself. So not self-funded, and I don't think a lot of the 30 for 30s are that way. I'm sure it's happened where someone's gone out and done a really cool sports doc and then sold it to ESPN, but in our case, that's not how it worked. It was kind of internally developed and then budgeted for.
So you're not a part of a production company. You're still part of ESPN when you made...
No, well, no. So I'm just a freelance director. So, you know, my relationship with Mike was such that we were developing it together. And so he could have, you know, he was a production company kind of in charge of the budget. So he could have, of course, just said, hey, thanks for developing this with me. I'm going to hire a different director, but obviously he would never do that. So I guess at the end of the day, it was Mike who hired me, but with the understanding that ESPN knew I was going to be the director. So Mike kind of had to hire me. I guess that's how it kind of works.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's cool, man. I want to kind of ask you a little bit about the film. There was a shot of Dennis entering the theater. It's kind of more like a candid shot, because I heard every time you schedule an appointment with him or an interview, he's always 2 hours late. And I don't know if that's true or not, but there's this beautiful shot of him. I mean, did you ask him to walk over to the chair, or was that somebody in your team that's ready with a gimbal and got him to walk to his chair and sit down?
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, you'd love for all those things to be candid. That certainly wasn't one of those moments. But I mean, I think it was probably just, I'm trying to remember if that was at the end or at the beginning. I think maybe when he just showed up, we said, oh, hey, Dennis, we'd love to get this theater is really cool. We'd love to get you in the bowels of it, kind of set up like where you are so people can see the stairwell and the stage and the seating behind you. So it was probably one of those things where when he arrived, we just said, hey, we're, instead of just sitting down and us tweaking lighting, we're just going to have you sit as if you're starting the interview. And you know, of course we had that all set up with the guy with the gimbal and that's how we kind of executed that.
So you knew that shot was going to happen before Before he even came in. Okay.
Yeah. I think probably in the weeks before we just said, oh yeah, it'd be cool if, you know, or when we scouted the theater, like, oh, this sort of hallway would be really cool to see him kind of walk up. I'm not sure how, maybe it was the day before, I don't remember, but yeah, it was something that we knew going into that day.
Why do the interview in a theater? Can you walk us through that process, and then also walk us through the process of your composition in that theater? I mean, it's just so beautifully done. Lighting, multiple cameras.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's funny. You want to have some artistic... Part of it was capturing who Dennis was. Part of it is also just, it was a really cool space. I mean, I looked at a lot of places, and part of it's logistical. He lives in Orange County, so we wanted to find, you know, as you mentioned, he shows up late, and you can ask me about that, but yeah, he's tough to get a handle on as an interview subject, so we wanted something that was close by where he lives and easy and accessible for him. So we found this great theater in Long Beach, downtown Long Beach, that, you know, was just a cool setting to interview someone. And I think before that we looked at a couple other theaters just because, you know, for Dennis, he's a showman. He's like this larger than life character who's, you know, you could argue that he's always, you know, putting on, and is he ever really himself when he's on TV? So there's this kind of actor stage play element, I think, that defines Dennis a little bit. So I think the theater made sense. And then just finding one near him that was like really cool looking was another challenge, but we eventually found it, and I think it was a cool setting.
Yeah, so like you said, he's probably really hard to just have come to the interview. So what was the process like just to get him to say yes? And then even beyond that, what was the process like to get him to open up and be so, like, even your last shot when he's crying, like, my heart broke for him and everything he had to say. He was so honest and vulnerable with you. What did it take to get him there?
I mean, the good thing, just to answer the first part of the question, I think the good thing about 30 for 30 is that, you know, athletes want to do them. I think it's a status thing. I think if you get a 30 for 30, it means you were like very important in the sports world for a long time, and people want to hear your story. And so Dennis, I think, you know, like I described earlier, it wasn't like we went to Dennis with, please do a 30 for 30. His agent was kind of wanting to do something with Dennis, and I think had talked to Dennis about it. So convincing him, I think, to do an interview or to do a 30 for 30 wasn't that hard. Which is nice. I think Dennis, to Dennis's credit, as difficult as he may have been to work with, I think he wanted it to be good. He wanted to try and open up as much as he could, and he wanted us to get the content that we wanted from him. Because like I said, I think he knew a lot of people would see it, and he knew it was a pretty important project for him. So in that case, we lucked out and got a good subject. But there's a massive but. I think Dennis is Dennis, and it was very difficult. You know, in these, well, I have to say too, I mean, we interviewed him for hours and hours and hours, on these days. I think we had like three or four interview days with him, and there were probably 4 or 5 hours of interviews each day, which is a lot. I mean, just imagine if you're sitting in a chair talking about your personal life for 5 hours straight. It's taxing, and the theater is expensive, so we can't do it over a month, and he's busy, he has the schedule, the production crew has, you know, a budget and schedule and all that stuff, so you kind of have to do it like that. So it's hard, so, you know, I sympathize with him on that. But yeah, I mean, he would show up late. He was just hard. I think we got, over those hours, we got enough for people to see who he was. And like you said, I think the ending was sad and revealing in some way. And we got a lot of those moments, which I think was good. But yeah, I mean, there were chunks of those interviews that were kind of nonsensical. And he, you know, he gets in certain moods and he starts talking about his sex life, or, you know, we talked a lot about North Korea because he's very proud of that. It's something we didn't need that much of. So he spends an hour and you always have to kind of redirect him back. But, you know, in terms to answer the second part of your question, just about, you know, I guess the trust needed for someone to open up to you. I don't think Dennis, I don't know, this sounds bad and I probably shouldn't say this, but I don't know as the filmmaker, Dennis necessarily like trusted me or that I was, you know, so great as an interviewer, or we built this relationship where he thought that he could trust me and that's why he opened up. I just think Dennis knew this was an important thing. And I think he's so vulnerable in certain ways and wants to get certain emotions and feelings out or can't help himself when you ask him certain questions, that that stuff, a lot of that stuff just came out. And I think, again, part of it was just the fact that he knew it was a 30 for 30 and a lot of people were going to see it. And we had prepped him a lot on like, hey, you just, let's let it all out here. Don't hold anything back and try to be as you know, honest as you can with all these things that we're going to ask you. And to his credit, he generally was pretty good at that.
So did you have any? Sorry, go ahead.
So you did all the interviews, right, Todd? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. So I did all, I mean, it was an exhausting project because we did obviously all those with Dennis, but then we interviewed, I don't know, 45 maybe other people. And these interviews are, they need to be thorough. So they're all multiple hours and, you know, it's a lot of people. And with Dennis, it's not all happy stuff you're talking about. There's infidelity and there's abandonment of kids and family issues and, you know, a lot of stuff that's not fun to talk about. So it was a taxing kind of year process of interviewing all these people. But, you know, the good thing about Dennis is people love him so much and his friends love him so much and his former teammates love him so much that they were all willing to do it. I mean, you know, Michael Jordan had done, who knows, hours and hours of interviews with Jason for The Last Dance, but still agreed to do Rodman's interview because, you know, he loves Dennis and wanted to do that for him. So and that, we found that Phil Jackson did a really long interview with us too. So people like Dennis and respect him enough that they wanted to step up and do interviews. So we got lucky in that way.
Yeah. Anna?
I was just going to say, do you have any advice for people who are in your shoes or even for me? I like want to be a sports broadcaster and whatever that means. And I'm pursuing that. And a lot of people are like, you need to have your interviewees trust you in 5 seconds to like open up to you to answer your question. Do you have advice on how you can get people to do that who really have no reason to trust you?
Yeah. I mean, Dennis was different because I just think he's such a crazy personality and a tough, right. Even on the fifth time that we worked together, it was just, like he'd come and he'd kind of like he'd get in moods and sometimes he'd be like, hey, what's up, man? And we'd have a good conversation about something. Other times he'd just stand there silently. So he was just a tough one to, there was probably no advice for how to get to know Dennis Rodman and to make him trust you. But for other people, because I've obviously had to convince a lot of people through the years to do features on, you know, I've done features on kids whose parents have died and you have to like convince them to open up and want to tell their story to millions of people. And that's hard. I would just say, and this is probably not the greatest advice, but first of all, I kind of disagree with the, if they don't trust you in 5 minutes sort of thing, or the fact that you should just be yourself and be compassionate. I mean, I think I've always found that that's the best way to do it. If you just call someone and, you know, if their father has died at a sporting event and you're trying to cover it, if you just call them and apply the appropriate amount of compassion to that person and not doing it because you want an interview, just doing it because that's the right thing to do. I've always found that that works. And I've had a lot of success sort of convincing people. Like I flew out, I did this amazing story on this family whose dad died of cancer and he only had like 2 months to live and they wanted to get him. He was a huge Cincinnati Reds fan and wanted to go to a game before he died. And they managed to get him there. He saw a no hitter and then he died actually the next day.
Wow.
Crazy story, but you know, that's a hard thing. It was like a week after he died and I basically flew to Cincinnati to just talk to these people in person and to sit down at dinner and tell them, hey, I want so badly to tell this story because I think it's an amazing story. It'll be a tribute to your father. And you just have to get to know people. And I think that's probably the best advice I could give is it is hard work to like genuinely get to know people and ask them questions and be sympathetic and compassionate. And I think that always works.
That's awesome. Quick question about the interview technicalities, Todd, as far as cameras and gear and stuff. Mm-hmm. I noticed there might've been three cameras, one main camera, and then one, maybe a camera with this on the sensor with a 50 lens maybe, and then there's a side camera. Can you walk us through your thought process there and equipment, lighting, and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously it sucks to have to say this, but a lot of it's like budgetary. I would love to have shot, I don't know, on like 35 millimeter film in anamorphic with Anavision lenses, but that's not in the budget really. But we shot, I think I would say 90% of the interviews we shot on Alexa Mini. Most of the interviews we had two cameras. We looked into certain lenses early on. We wanted to kind of pick a set and try to use them throughout, which I think we did a good job on. Again, it's a budget thing when you have a one-off interview that you know is not that important. You're not going to rent a $2,000 set of lenses for, you know, an hour interview. So we didn't all the time, but we used, we landed on the Cook Pancros, which are, I think they're the Cook Pancro Classics. Cook made these lenses in like the 20s and 30s, all the way through the 60s. And they sort of recently, I don't know if this history is completely accurate, but I think recently they brought them kind of the glass back and put them in kind of modern housings. And they have this little bit of a vintagey look, and Cooks are obviously known too for having this kind of painterly feel, more so than like Zeiss lenses. So they just seemed like cool lenses to use. So we use those for most of the interviews. And yeah, and compositionally, I think what I told, so Logan Fulton is the DP who did, I would say 80% of the doc, and he did all the interviews. And he was great. He was like a young, kind of a cool up and comer. When we had conversations, I just told him, I just want to see these people in their spaces. I want kind of a wide shot. I want to see where they are. I want them to be a part of the environment rather than like, you know, a lot of, and I've done all these kind of interview looks before, but I didn't want the heavy lighting and the backgrounds falling off or like tight into camera. I kind of wanted to see them in their space. So that was kind of the aesthetic that we went with for most of the interviews or tried. I mean, obviously you're limited by spaces. It's hard, you know, when you are told Michael Jordan is going to do this at his restaurant and you have this tiny room in the back and that's where you're going to do it. You kind of have to adjust a little bit and that always happened, or, you know, there's a lot of different.
Well, the compositions of the interviews are, I mean, it's different. You don't see that composition very often, you know, how you guys framed that. So were you behind, obviously, the camera, you were looking at the composition and all that stuff. And I mean, you probably already, okay, 100%, that's it. That's how I want it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a conversation. You show up to the space. Sometimes we knew what it was going to be. Sometimes we didn't. And Logan and I would say, okay, like, what's the coolest shot in here? And what's the most interesting composition we can get out of this space? The producer and I, Mitch Leff, laughed a lot because we always made fun of Logan because, you know, we did multiple interviews a day, and we had to go from, when you're in Chicago, we had to set up at a restaurant and then go to like an Airbnb we had rented for someone else. So there was a lot of movement. So it's not like we could set up 50 lights and have, you know, all these grip and lighting people coming and going for budgetary reasons and just for logistics. So we just joke that it was the Logan Fulton special, who was the DP, was like a silk with a sky panel behind it. Because a lot of times it was, we used natural light and then we threw the sky panel up and the silk. And that's sort of belittling what an amazing job Logan did, but it was just like a funny joke we had. So it was the Logan special, was just the silk with the one light. But that's what we had to do. And to his credit, you know, he made all those interviews look really great with limited time and limited budget in a lot of cases. So.
Yeah. And I think Anna has a question about the very, very opening shot as far as the ocean and then the little details about Miss Shirley.
Yeah. So I thought the opening was super witty and creative. And I really enjoyed how you guys, right off the bat, it was super creative. So was that, again, was that like a thing you had in mind before? Or with the narrator, was he involved in that? Or what was the process in the open, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I always, for the whole project, I wanted, you know, I think all the stuff that Mike and I and Matt and I, Mike Hughes and Matt Schleff, who were at the production company, that we've done a lot of projects together, and everything that I've done with them, and I love them because they always want to do this too, and they appreciate this thought process, is let's make this like different than what's been done and what we're doing. So, you know, 30 for 30s don't really usually open with sort of cinematic storytelling, I guess. And I always wanted to do that and kind of, you know, give ESPN and the 30 for 30 series something that maybe they hadn't seen before in that way. So it was always in the back of my mind that I wanted to execute something. The stressful part was we're shooting it and you're always trying to save budget along the way. So, cause you know, that shoot cost, I don't know, it cost a decent portion of the budget. And you had to have that money by the end to do it. And I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do, you know, as we were going along. So I think just as we were doing interviews and I was thinking about how to frame Dennis's story and how, when we started editing, I just kind of had a big document going of like what the open could be, you know, what are we trying to hit people with right off the bat? What do we need to say about Dennis? What do we want to say about what the film is going to be and what it's going to look like and feel like? So just over months and months and months, I just kept thinking about what would be cool. Sometimes that's always just the first question to ask is what would be fun and cool and interesting to do if you have the money. And I think I just came up with the idea of kind of the passing through doors because, you know, Dennis is 60. He's opened a lot of doors and there's been some strange, crazy things on the other side of it. So I just wanted to show this kind of seamless flow of a person kind of opening and closing all these doors. And, you know, so the writing kind of informed some of that too, because we wanted to impress this idea that, you know, if there's the cliche, the journey versus the destination cliche, which I actually think is probably true. But I think in Dennis's case, journey was amazing. But as we see at the end of the film, you know, he's a broken man in a lot of ways. And the destiny or the journey might have been great with for him. The doors that he opened may have been great, but where he is now is kind of sad. So we wanted to kind of tell that story too. And I think the open kind of helped set that up.
Another small detail was when Shirley Rodman was playing the piano and you rewinded her hands in the middle of the two interviews. Was that, again, I guess the same question, did you prompt her to do that? Did you prompt her to play the piano? Like, what's the process to have these people be like, hey, can you play the piano? Like, do you play the piano? What was that interview like and how'd you get that?
Yeah, first of all, Shirley was my favorite part of the doc, just like the experience with her, because I think she's a really interesting lady. You know, you could argue whether or not you think she's a good mother or not, and I have my feelings on that, but I think, you know, when you show up to these people's homes interviewing them, you're always kind of looking for that extra little something if you can get it. You know, we were at Shirley's house for a few hours, we did the interview, and then you see this lovely piano, you know, next to the couch, and you start asking her about, oh, do you play the piano? And then you find out, oh, she plays gospel music at her church every Sunday, and she's done that for 20 years. And then you start joking with her and like, oh, you should score the film. And then eventually, if she feels comfortable enough, you say, hey, do you mind playing something that you play at church, and we'll shoot it. It's just cool to see Dennis Rodman's mom playing a sort of gospel ballad. So yeah, that's just a question we asked her if she'd do it, and we shot it. In terms of the rewinding it, that just happened in edit. Jason Sanchez is an editor I work with a lot, and he edited the Rodman thing. And I think we were just like editing that section, and it's sort of, I think the impetus actually was I said, there was a little part of that song that actually sounded like it could be like a hip hop beat. That if you sampled it and put like drums and a snare to it, it would be something like, you know, it could be like a hit on the radio in terms of hip hop. So I think I actually downloaded just like a break beat and then put it over it, and it sounded cool. And so Jason and I just started talking like, what if we rewound it and like added instruments to her piano? And Dan Teicher, who scored a lot of parts of the film, we asked him, we said, hey, if we send this thing to you, do you think you could put like drums behind it or strings, or we want to make what Shirley played into like a part of the score? And he did, and he made like a cool little kind of minute long thing with her piano in it. And then the rewinding just felt like, hey, Shirley's playing this thing. Now we're going to rewind it and give you something a little different. We're going to add to it. And I think, yeah, that was a cool part of the doc. I'm actually proud of that. We kind of came up with
that. That's sick, man. That's awesome. That's really cool. How is that interview process? Is it like you flew in? Is she in Detroit? Where was she?
They live in Dallas. He's from Dallas. Yeah.
So you and your team, like, walk us through the team. Like, you had two other guys with you, and then cameras, and then her home. And how was that?
Yeah. So pretty much the travel team, I guess, was Logan, who was the DP. Matt Schleff, who went to, I think, every city and interview, was the producer. And that was kind of it. I mean, we brought audio, Brian LaHare, who's a friend of mine, and he's like an audio tech. I think he traveled with us to a couple of the interviews, but usually we would just get local audio. So a lot of the travel was just the three of us, and we'd hire local crews. So we'd get a couple grips. Again, all we had was a light panel and a silk anyway, so we really didn't need that many bodies, but yeah, that was kind of the travel crew, the three of us, and then we'd hire locally and roll up to these people's homes and try to make them feel comfortable and set up for a few hours and do a long, arduous 3-hour interview and move on to something else the next day.
Man, you guys did a good job. You got a lot of content and a lot of these guys with such a minimal setup. You mentioned something earlier about editing. Somebody edited. But did you play a part at all as far as physically editing it, or were you next to him, or how did that process go?
Yeah, I mean, Jason and I were in the same room together for about 8 months, so we knew each other before, but we certainly know each other a lot better now. And in terms of like me physically editing, it's just very like we had a room where Jason had his set up, and there's a couch there, and half the time I'm sitting on the couch and we're just talking through things and editing together with him physically doing it. But then there's another computer in the room with the project loaded. And so sometimes we would simultaneously edit different sections of the doc together. And then I'd send him a piece of, I actually do really love editing. And I think a lot of times these docs can just be made and edit. You can have a shoot some great stuff. And if you just muck up the edit, then, you know, it's just editing can really elevate content a lot. And I'm really hypersensitive to that. So a lot of times I do like to be hands-on and I edit physical. I always like editing the opens and closes too. I'm always, those are my babies. So I'll do a pass or 20 passes at those and then hand it off to the professional to kind of clean it up and make it a little more elegant. But I edited big chunks of Dennis, but Jason Sanchez did a lot of the heavy lifting for those months and months and months.
What about, did you hire a colorist to, and then how did you decide on the look of the entire film?
Yeah, the colorist we brought in, it was great because his schedule was really flexible. So he came in for a couple weeks where we were just like messing around with looks. So he would, we had DaVinci in the office, so he'd come in, load up DaVinci, load up the interviews. He'd sit in the next room and sort of come up with some different looks after we talked, give me different options, and I'd come in and kind of give him feedback. And so that was like a couple week process of just like looking at what we wanted the look to be.
Yeah.
I was really happy with the way sort of the aesthetic of the whole thing turned out.
That's awesome, man. I mean, the look is awesome. I mean, it's just, you can feel it, you know? I mean, you guys did such a good job.
Yeah, I mean, that was, again, I think all the 30 for 30s are so great, especially content wise. I just think for us, we wanted to add this kind of element of I don't know if it's creativity, but just thinking hard about, sometimes in this business, especially in sports TV, you don't have a lot of time or the budget to think about like lenses or the color grade. But we really wanted to spend time with the technical part to make it look as great as it could.
Well, it was very obvious, but with the budget that you guys are working with, you made the best out of it and it looks amazing. I mean, at the end of the day, it's really not really about the equipment. It's, you just make the best out of what you got, yeah, right?
Exactly.
And I had a question about somebody who, and I'm going to let you take this over.
Yeah. So you guys had a lot of people you interviewed, but was there anyone that you really wanted that wasn't able to participate? I read where Scottie Pippen was asked, but he couldn't. But was there anybody else that you really thought would change the documentary?
Yeah, I was bummed that Scottie didn't agree. And I don't know. I mean, there's many things. I think he had things going on in his personal life, which was one. And then I think I am speculating on this, and I didn't see all the Last Dance, so I don't know what his interview was like there. But I don't. I think he always probably thought Dennis overshadowed him a little bit, and I don't think anyone's going to argue that Dennis Rodman's a better basketball player than Scottie Pippen. But Dennis got up the 30 for 30, and Scottie didn't, so that may have been part of it too. So that was a bummer that we didn't get him. You know, we got most of the people we wanted. The fact that we got Jordan and Isaiah Thomas. I think Madonna would have been cool to get. We didn't even get a response, I don't think, from her people. But she wasn't, you know, she would have been a 1 minute soundbite anyway, probably, had we had got her. So actually, I would say Scottie. And then the second guy, we didn't get Greg Popovich, who was his coach, who's still the coach, obviously, with the Spurs. It was actually the general manager. I think he was the GM when Dennis was there. They had a terrible relationship, it seemed like. And, you know, Greg Popovich is the military guy, and Dennis obviously doesn't fit that mold. So I think they butted heads a lot. So he, I think, would have been, because he's really intelligent and interesting, Greg Popovich. So I would have loved to hear his take on it, but he didn't want anything to do with it. So that was a little bit of a bummer. But other than that, I don't think so. We had a Carmen Electra initially said no, or didn't work out scheduling wise. And then near the end of the doc kind of came around and said, oh, I can do an interview if you guys want it. But at that point we had cut down kind of that segment of Dennis's life to such a short chunk that it wouldn't have made any sense to interview her. So we kind of passed on that. But
who arranged all these interviews for you, Todd? Were just you, or did you have a producer?
Yeah. So Matt Schleff, the producer, did a lot of that. We kind of just did it all together, just emailing and begging. And Matt did a lot of, like, especially with Isaiah Thomas, he went through a lot to get that interview. Because these guys are busy, and they talked about all these things a lot. And, you know, if you saw the doc, Isaiah got emotional. So obviously that was, you know, everyone doesn't want to sit down for an hour and be brought to tears. So it does take some convincing to get all those interviews. So yeah, it was a lot of work just to get these people and to schedule them and all that stuff. So Matt did a lot of that.
Yeah, man, the interviews was just, it was beautifully done.
I know in The Last Dance, people were talking about how they chose to interview everyone before Michael Jordan so that they could show him and everyone saw his response. Did you have a similar approach?
Yeah, we tried to do that. I think we did. I think the idea was we did probably like 60% of the interviews, maybe, or all the ones we could get out of the way. And then we did Dennis's first interview, so we had some ammo to ask him things. And then I think we did the rest of them, and then he was one of our last, like, because we interviewed him a few times. So I think the second time we did was he was one of the last, so we could again kind of follow up with certain things.
Yeah.
I mean, the tough thing about Dennis, and I don't want to say this in a disparaging way, but the details were lost upon him a lot. So it was difficult. He contradicted other people a lot. He contradicted himself from one interview to the next. That might've been one of the biggest challenges in the doc, is like piecing together all these stories. And I think I actually had a little trouble with that in The Last Dance too, where people, you know, people remember things differently. It's interesting, actually, he told us a story that was in The Last Dance, but Dennis told it completely differently, where it wasn't Michael Jordan who went to his apartment to wake him up one morning, it was Phil Jackson. So all these details kind of get, you know, jumbled in people's minds, which is natural, but that was a challenge too, just with someone like Dennis, who's gone through so much stuff, and a lot of it was in a drunken stupor, so it's kind of hard to keep stuff straight in that way, but...
So who really came to get him in Vegas? Was it Michael Jordan really that knocked on the door and says, hey, Dennis, come on?
The story Dennis told us was more about in Chicago, he had a big weekend of partying and didn't show up for practice. And it was like, I think it was the playoffs. So it was really important. And he said that Phil Jackson just kind of opened his door and walked into his bedroom and kind of like dragged him out of bed. So that wasn't the Vegas story. And I know, you know, that made a lot of headlines, the Vegas thing from The Last Dance. And I don't know.
Well, Carmen Electra said, because the way they like pieced it together was, I'm not going to tell you who was in the bed when I walked in there. And Carmen Electra was like, oh, and it was Michael Jordan. And that was her introduction to the doc. So she said it. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if she has it right either, but.
Yeah. And maybe she was probably had the most sense out of anyone in that story. But I mean, he had so many. And that was the other thing that was really hard for me as the person kind of dictating the content is like, there was a lot of fun, funny sex, drug stuff that we had to leave out just because we wanted to get more at like who Dennis is. Which is hard because you know you're going to get the laughs and you're going to get like the headlines if you include some of this stuff. Like we had interesting, weird, like sex stories about Carmen
Electra.
Some of them. But there were a lot that just were awesome that hit the cutting room floor, and it was painful to do it. But I always had to say, like, what are we really trying to tell here? What stories are we trying to tell? And so a lot of that got cut out that probably would have been, really cool headlines and publicity for the film, but it just didn't feel right to,
on all that stuff. Is there going to be like a sequel with like the unseen footage and the interview?
There should. I mean, the thing too about the like our business is you know what allotment of time you're given for something, because I promise you I could have made a 3 or 4 hour series on Dennis that would have been really interesting and probably even more insightful because you can go more in depth on certain things. But you know, we had 102 minutes and you have to cram all that stuff in somehow, and you know, we did it. You can always do it, you can always make something shorter, but you know, I would have, in retrospect, I think if we would have done a three-parter each being an hour, I think we could have told. There were a lot of interesting things about race too that we didn't get in with Dennis. You know, now that obviously is an important issue that people are talking about, and I think, you know, a lot of elements of his story, I think, add to that discussion in a lot of ways, and a lot of that stuff got cut just for time. And so, yeah, I think if we would have had it's arrogant to say, oh, we should have got 3 hours instead of 102 minutes. But I think we had the stuff to do something that would have been really cool.
Do you think if you released it, I think September, if I'm not mistaken, if you waited a little longer and it happened during a pandemic, do you think it would have gotten a three-parter? Have you thought about that?
Yeah. I mean, what I've thought more about is just what's interesting, and I'm very thankful, is that I think probably – I mean, I don't know what the rating was. It was like a 1 point something. So, you know, millions of people saw the Rodman doc when it aired in September. I would argue that 10 times the amount of people saw it over the last, you know, 2 months because of The Last Dance. I think a lot of people said, especially people who love Michael Jordan but aren't huge basketball fans, they saw this Dennis Rodman character and they kind of wanted more. So I just saw a lot of friends sent me tweets of people kind of directing, you know, directing people to our doc just to kind of get a more in-depth look at Dennis. So I think a lot of people discovered the Rodman thing after The Last Dance and all the people see
that. A lot of people my age had no clue who he was. Like, I honestly, I was born in 95, so I have no recollection of any of that. But my dad was like, oh my gosh, you don't know who Dennis Rodman is? And I know a lot of people my age were, I'm sure they went back and watched the doc because, yeah, I had no clue.
Yeah, that's crazy. But yeah, it was cool that people got to see it and didn't catch it the first time around. And a lot of people, it's kind of insulting though when you look on Twitter and people are like, we need a Dennis Rodman 30 for 30. It's like,
okay. It is ESPN Plus. I interned at NFL Films, and I was part of the Pain Places way before it was a thing, and I helped with the Stick'Em interview, and the producers had me put together kind of, I forget what they called it, but it was almost like just footage of it, so they could show Pain, you know, footage from it back then, he could speak to it. But a lot of people don't know that. So how do you get these guys to recall, like Dennis, remember when he was 10 years old, or Shirley to remember that long ago?
Yeah. I mean, again, Dennis, it's very hard, and a lot of stuff he didn't use because it was confusing and he forgot. And I think the important stuff he got, I mean, the thing to remember, I think, with a lot of these athletes and even my wife, who was a former Olympic athlete, is they talk about these things a lot. Mm-hmm. This wasn't the first time that Dennis was recalling a lot of these stories and talking about his time at the Pistons and with the Bulls. They kind of, all these athletes have their talking points and stuff that they think is important and interesting that they want to get out. So it is interesting, though. I mean, even like Jordan, like these guys kind of remember everything. And part of it is, Michael Jordan probably does an interview when he was playing, he did interviews every day for 15 years. So you kind of just, you remember the story you told 5 years ago, and then you remember the same story you told 10 years ago. But yeah, there wasn't, to be honest, I don't think there was a lot of showing people stuff. I mean, I think with Dennis, since we did interview him late, we were able to say like, oh, Phil said, That was very helpful, I think, with Dennis, is to say, oh, Phil said at this one practice you did this. And I think even if Dennis didn't remember, he'd just be like, oh, yeah, like, and he'd just kind of repeat the story that we told him that Phil said, which was fine. But but yeah, that's a hard thing because people don't remember everything, and stories do get jumbled. And I don't know that we did a lot besides for Dennis just prompting him and telling him, kind of reminding him of stories that other people told us.
That's awesome, man. What you guys have done an incredible amount of research before this project, before you started shooting, because you went back all the way back to his younger days. And how were you able to get access to those pictures and those videos of him playing, things like that? How were you able to do that? Was that your producer? Was that you?
Yeah, I mean, it's both of us. I mean, Matt, again, did a lot of that dirty work. And that's the hardest, that's the most frustrating thing, I think, about doing these docs, is when you start to say, like, oh, his, like, childhood was super interesting and his Oklahoma experience was awesome. Like, how are we going to show? You can't just have Dennis talking about it or have teammates talking about it, because that's, you know, not what visual storytelling is. You need evidence. You need photos, or at least you need to try to shoot reenactments, or you know, you need to really paint a picture for people, I guess. So that's one of the things that's so important to me and so scary when you go into these projects, is if that stuff exists. And if you see it anywhere, I would always tell Matt, I'd like find some random clip somewhere, or in a book, I'd see a photo. I'd be like, we have to find this. You know, this is like, it's Dennis playing pinball when he was 23 years old at the arcade. Like, where is this video? And to Matt's credit, he did a lot of digging. He flew to Detroit, went to a lot of the local affiliates and kind of dug through. I mean, he would send me pictures of, he'd be in the basement of the tape library and there'd just be like, not organized at all, just like racks of tapes that would just say like Pistons 1986, and Matt would scroll through the whole tape. So, you know, it's a lot of legwork to get those photos, and you have to ask people if they have stuff. Shirley was kind enough to kind of give us stuff, but even and then they're they don't know what's important. They don't know what's cool. So you have to ask, like, what do you have? Any VHS? Do you have, what photos do you have? You really have to kind of be direct with them about what you need. And yeah, I think generally, I think we had enough stuff to show kind of Dennis's the different kind of eras of his life. We got, like, we found his, Matt did a lot of work to find the original mugshot photos of Dennis when he got arrested, when he was, you know, 17, which was cool. It was cool to see those. They existed online, but they were really low res. I don't know who had them, but we found the originals. And so, yeah, that takes a lot of effort to find all that stuff.
Yeah, it was crazy how you guys were able to find all that stuff, even some of the footage during his high school days.
Yeah.
Was there anything that, I mean, I feel like your answer is going to be no after you talked about Rodman, but was there anything that you asked him that he didn't answer or that you wanted more out of him?
No. Again, I think it's like a different type of interview with him.
Right.
I think if you were, you know, I don't know if you guys saw like Lance Armstrong, they came out with his 30 for 30 these past weeks, and you watch that and it's like, this is a man, if you hate him or love him, he's still articulating everything, he remembers everything. Mm-hmm. Dennis just wasn't really, and I love Dennis, and he was really open in a lot of parts, and I think he was able to articulate his feelings sometimes, but I think I think there was a lot of topics that I just think he forgot or he was distracted that day and wasn't great on. I think the only thing that we had a little bit of an issue on was the North Korea stuff. And that was a hard thing to treat in the doc too, because you go through this whole life and then it's just kind of plopped in at the end, in terms of his story. So it's like, how do you fit that in? And then also at the time when we were interviewing him, in 2000, I guess it's early 2019, it was when Trump had gone, and people were kind of giving him, Dennis a lot of credit for that. So I think his people and him thought they could parlay that into another documentary or a TV show or just money and publicity for him. So there were conversations about, let's try not to get too much into North Korea. And that was a little frustrating to not be able to get the kind of content from him on that stuff. And he wasn't great when we asked him questions about North Korea. He'd always just divert to these weird stories about when he visited and things he saw. So I would say the North Korea thing was challenging just in terms of the stuff he wasn't necessarily hugely comfortable in asking or answering. But I think that was also just they were trying to save that stuff potentially for another opportunity.
Yeah. What's next for you, Todd? Talk about what you're working on.
Yeah, right now I'm working on, I think it's a really great story. It's a shorter, it was actually initially going to be just like a 15 to 20 minute kind of long feature. But I, partially because of the pandemic and I had the time, and partially because it's a really great story that deserves more time, we turned it into kind of 44 minute TV hour. And it's on this guy, Jose Rodriguez, who's a PGA Tour golfer. And he has a crazy story. He came to the U.S. when he was 16 as an undocumented immigrant, sort of crossed the Rio in Texas. It has a pretty crazy crossing story. He tried for months. He was homeless along the border in Mexico, trying to figure out how to, you know, when you're 15 or 16, he's trying to navigate crossing the border illegally. It's very complicated and very difficult, and you don't speak the language and all that. So he crossed when he was 16. He ended up working at a golf course, learning the game a little bit. And after 9/11, he was kind of forced to come home because there was obviously a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment, you know, after 9/11, a lot of which weirdly was put onto Mexican immigrants when we've never caught a terrorist crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. But anyway, he went home. He started caddying at his home course in Mexico. He met someone who decided to sponsor him to start playing. He turned out to be like a prodigy golfing, and now he's a PGA Tour level golfer. So the doc or the piece kind of tries to tell two stories. It tells his personal story, which I find remarkable and really interesting. But I also wanted to tell kind of this dual story of, you know, he was born in he's, I think he's 39 now. So he's a few years older than me. I think he was born in 1980. So I wanted to tell 1980 to now, what are all the politics and sort of these world political forces and just general forces that that sort of determine the ebb and flow of immigrants in and out of the country. And I think, you know, you have NAFTA, you have, like I mentioned, you have 9/11, you have, you know, Clinton in 96 had some pretty harsh immigration policy. Obviously now we don't need to get into sort of what our current president is doing, but I wanted to tell also a narrative of all these presidents throughout those 35 years of his life, what was happening politically that was kind of driving him to go to the US to come back and all the challenges that he faced. So that's what I'm working on now. It's been a challenge since I've been at my home office for 2 straight months, not talking to anyone about it and just staring at it. Usually you at least have an editor to talk about choices and the story, but it's just been me. So we'll see when it comes out if anyone likes it, because it's just been me in my office. But I think it's a really remarkable story, and Jose is an amazing person. So I hope a lot of people see it.
When's your target? When is that going to air and where?
Hopefully it's going to be on the Golf Channel. I kind of have a rough cut done that I'm going to send them soon. So they'll want to promote it probably for a few weeks, and then hopefully they'll get it on the air. So I would guess, if I had to guess, late July or early August. So pretty soon.
That's awesome, man. Can't wait to see that.
Yeah.
If you were to talk to 18, 20-year-old, 22-year-old Todd, what advice would you give that person to get to this level where you are?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to another friend about that the other day, and what I kind of came up with, and which is not, I don't know that this is the best advice, but for me, I think looking back at like where I was in college or even early on at ESPN, and I sort of mentioned it early on in terms of the trajectory of my career, but you know, I always wanted to be a filmmaker, and I was scared, I think, a little bit to kind of fully commit to that. And I think that's probably why I went to Brown and I'll major in history and political science because it's interesting to me, but also I could go to law school, or it's the sort of practical choice while still taking film classes and always having that dream kind of not on the back burner, but just kind of it's there, but I'm not pursuing it as aggressively as I can. And I think that's the same reason why I took the job at ESPN. It's like, it's creative and I can edit and I like sports and I get that world. And so I'll do that. I'm not going to like go to film school, or I'm not going to like make a film on my own. But I guess my point being, I don't think it's probably worth like fighting who you are. I was never going to be the person probably who at 18 was going to like get a bunch of my friends and, you know, direct a film and send it to film festivals or apply for film school. And I just wasn't that person. So I took a different path that I think, you know, at the end of the day, I'm like really happy where I've gotten in terms of being able to direct full-length documentaries now. And that's kind of where I wanted to be 15 years ago when I started having all these dreams. So I guess the advice would just be that don't create sort of all this anxiety for yourself because you're not pursuing it in the way that you think you should be pursuing something. I think I always thought I might get to where I want to get in a roundabout way, but that's okay. So I would just trust who you are and trust the path you want to take and not be so hard on yourself if you're not doing exactly how you think you should, you know, approach your career.
That's awesome, man. I appreciate your time, man. That was a lot of awesome information and answering our questions. I loved your show. Anna watched it. Was it yesterday, Anna, when you watched?
Yeah, I watched it yesterday. So it's fresh in my mind. I loved it. It was really well done.
Thanks.
I always try to ask, the last question is, where can people find you, Todd? Instagram, website, you take it from here.
Yeah, I don't really use Twitter, although I have it, but I'm probably most active on Instagram, which is @ToddKapp, TODDKAP. So I usually like to post. It's a good mix of fun with my wife and work projects. So that's pretty.
That's awesome. I love the videos you made. I was telling Anna earlier about when you guys went on honeymoon in Indonesia or in Southeast Asia, you made some videos of your trip.
How'd you make that?
Yeah, those are really fun for me because I tell Tara this all the time because, you know, when there's pressure to edit something great for Rodman or the thing I'm working on now, you're sitting in there and there's this little kind of bird on your shoulder that's telling you that, you know, a lot of people are going to watch this and there's a lot of scrutiny on this, but those videos, it doesn't matter. They're just fun vacation videos. So I love doing those and it's a good sort of break from, you know, editing real stuff. But yeah, I always try to take my, I have like a Sony A7S.
S2.
I always take that on S2. And I always try to kind of take that along with me. And we go to these beautiful places, so it's not hard to get beautiful images in these places. So I just take the camera along, shoot a bunch of stuff when we have downtime, and then try to splice it together into something interesting. So I love doing that. It's really fun. And it's a good, we always look back at those videos years later. It's just awesome that we have them too, because you know, you forget a lot of the places you've been and things you've seen if you don't have, you know, you have pictures, but it's cool having a video.
Yeah. The more I think about it now, is there a dream in the back of your head to be a travel filmmaker? Because, I mean, that was like the way you made that. It's just so beautiful.
Well, we always, Tara and I always talk about, because we love, obviously, traveling. So wouldn't that be the dream to, like, you know, someone pays us to go on these trips and I just film Tara in these exotic locations? I'd take that in a second.
Yeah.
Haven't had any calls for that yet. So if anyone's listening.
Yeah.
have any money, we'll do that.
Call your people. Let their people to call your people, right? That's so awesome, Todd. Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun talking to you guys.
Sorry. You guys, hopefully you make it back down to Charleston to your home.
I know. I'm hoping to get down there soon.
Your 1 year anniversary, well, not 1 year anniversary, more like, is it 3 year anniversary?
Three. Yeah, three.
Awesome. Well, good luck with everything with your project. We're looking forward to seeing it and watching it in July or August, whenever it comes out. Let us know. And thank you again so much. So grateful for your time. You take care.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.